Okay, this is lecture number 3 in Apologetics 2. What I wanted to do was give an overview of the history of apologetics. Now, we've only got 8 guys that we're going to cover in the history of apologetics, at least what I would call 8 good guys, defenders of the faith. And then, although some of the good guys, some of their arguments backfired, and then we're going to talk about some philosophers who attacked traditional apologetics, and I'm only going to bring up 5 there. Now, obviously, there's more than 8 defenders of the faith throughout church history, and there's more than 5 guys who attacked traditional apologetics throughout history. So what I'm doing, I just picked big-name people whose thought had something big to contribute to traditional apologetics, either pro or con. Okay? But I want to accomplish 2 things by going over these. Don't come out of these classes thinking you're going to be an expert on Augustine or Aquinas. But what I want to accomplish is, number one, show that what we're doing is not new. Norman Geisler, and he'd be the first to admit it, is not the first guy to come up with this stuff. In fact, Geisler's written an excellent book on Thomas Aquinas and openly admits that much of his argumentation comes from Aquinas. And he's also edited a work on Augustine that's out of print. It's not new. This has been done throughout the history of the church. Now, we showed that the apostles defended the faith. But we're going to see that throughout church history, the same was done by many other great saints throughout the history of the church. So that's number one. I want us to know that what we're doing is not something new. This has been done throughout the history of the church. And number two, I just want us to see some of the main aspects of this course, some of the main arguments that we're going to be using. I want us to see that in the thought of these gentlemen throughout history. So it's just a brief overview, but it's going to take a little bit more time than I had intended. Now, the first guy we got on the list is St. Augustine. And Augustine lived from 354 A.D. to 430 A.D. His 2 most famous works, he's got plenty of works, but are his Confessions, which is basically his testimony. Now, if you're the kind of person who likes reading philosophical stuff and you're not big on testimonies, that doesn't mean that you wouldn't be interested in this book. This is the way a testimony is supposed to be written. He doesn't glorify sin, but at the same time, he emphasizes the depravity of man. A very humble testimony, but at the same time, it's kind of his pilgrimage in thought. And so it's very, very, extremely philosophical work, but that's his testimony, his Confessions. And then his the City of God, which is, it's the City of God versus the City of Man, or the City of Satan, if you will. It's kind of Augustine's philosophy of history. Now, history of philosophy would be a history of philosophical thought, but a philosophy of history would be a person's interpretation of, you know, attempt to make sense out of history. And Augustine, being a Christian thinker, he used his Christian worldview in the City of God and attempted to give his philosophy, his view of history. Augustine was converted from Manichaeanism, and Manichaeanism was a non-Christian cult or religion which believed in metaphysical dualism. Metaphysical dualism. What I mean by metaphysical dualism is that they believed that there are 2 ultimate principles in reality, not just one. But there's an all-good principle and an all-evil principle that are in eternal warfare against each other, okay? The reason why I had to call it metaphysical dualism, because it means that all reality can be broken down into 2 ultimate beings, and then from there everything else came on the scene. I was differentiating it from epistemological dualism, which would just mean the existence of the knower and the object known. We just started. Okay, so he was converted from this. Now, this is a real important point, because the reason why Augustine was in Manichaeanism was he thought at that time that it had the best explanation for the problem of evil. The conversion of Augustine to Christianity is basically one of the greatest thinkers who ever lived trying to solve the problem of evil. And for a while he thought that the Manichaean heresy had the answer, that since evil exists, there must be an all-good ultimate principle and an all-evil ultimate principle. Break it down in layman terms, two gods, an all-good God and an all-evil God, an eternal battle against each other. And he thought that solved the problem. But then he came up with some questions of his own, and he went to one of the Manichaean leaders, and the guy spoke real well, but then couldn't answer his questions, and he started to realize that the answer to the problem of evil really wasn't there. And he got into Neoplatonic thought, which was basically the views of Plato, where they had gotten to by that time. He's living about six or seven hundred years after Plato. And eventually, under the preaching of Ambrose, he eventually found that Christianity had the answer to the problem of evil, and he eventually became a Christian. His mother, Monica, was constantly in prayer for him. He had lived an immoral lifestyle before he was saved. But the key, again, though, is the conversion of Augustine was the fact that he was looking around for the true philosophy, and he found in Christianity the true worldview of life, and the only thing that the only system of thought that adequately answered the problem of evil. Now, when we mention arguments and some of the thought of these guys, all I want to do is whet your appetite with their thought. I do not want to go in real in-depth dealing with the problem of evil. We're going to spend more time on that later on in our lectures. Even then, we're not going to spend as much time as I would like. But the fact of the matter is, right here, we're just going to touch on it. He basically, one of the problems he had was, how could evil come into existence? If there's just an all-good, all-powerful God, and he created everything, how can evil exist? If everything God created was good, how could evil exist? And what he realized was that evil is a privation. Everything that God created is good, yet evil exists. Evil is a perversion of the good which God created. It's an abuse of human and angelic free will. So it's a privation. It's a perversion or a corruption of the good that should be there. Okay? So, basically, evil exists much like rust exists in a car. Nobody made the rust, but a corruption of that metal, comes into play. And so evil exists as a privation or a perversion or a lack of a good that should be there. The absence of sight in a rock is not evil, because rocks were never intended to have the perfection of sight. But when a human being who has eyes cannot see, or cannot see because they've lost their eyes, that is an evil. Now, it's not saying that person is evil, but it's saying that in God's perfect creation, that person was created to see and that person would see. But because of the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and the results, hence come evil and human suffering. And because of that, we have people who are created to see that cannot see. It's not just a lack. A lack, you know, a rock lacks sight. But the fact that a rock can't see is not a privation, because it's not a lack of something that's supposed to be there. So privation is a lack of something that's supposed to be there. Okay? And so Augustine argued that evil is a privation, and it's caused by the abuse of human and angelic free will. God gave us the freedom to say yes to God, to obey His will, or to rebel against Him and to disobey His will. And by disobeying God's will, the consequences of that, a man reaps what he sows, and we bring evil and human suffering into existence, basically as a perversion, a corruption of God's good creation. But then Augustine would still argue that God allowed man to make those that free choice in the garden. He allowed evil for the purpose of a greater good. And We don't have time to argue exactly what that greater good might be and that type of thing at this point. We'll take a look at that later on in this course. You know, right now I'm really not attempting for us to do apologetics. What I'm trying to show you is how these guys did it and just give you an overview of it. So even if you don't fully understand their arguments, just get the overview of it, the gist of what they're saying. And later on, we'll use some of their arguments, and sometimes, like with Anselm, I don't like some of his arguments. Augustine, we need to understand that he was influenced by Plato's thought. Plato held to the belief in the invisible world of unchanging, eternal ideas or truths. For instance, in Plato's thought, ultimate reality is not particular individual chairs, but the eternal, unchanging idea, chairness, the essence of that chair, the invisible definition of that chair. And though a lot of people wouldn't go that far, I think there are some eternal ideas, such as equality. You can look at two equal things. I was talking to J.P. Moreland on that, and he was in total agreement with me, and he liked it so much that the next day at the breakfast, he used that as an illustration to prove one of his points. But if you looked at two equal cups, there's no way, from your sense experience, observing, perceiving those two cups, there's no way that you can come up with a concept, the invisible, immaterial concept, equality. In other words, our minds went into that observation with the concept of equality already there. Now, it's another argument whether it's in the conscious realm or the subconscious realm. But the fact of the matter is, it's somehow we see two things that are equal in size, and it triggers from, I would say, from the subconscious realm, from the subconscious mind, it triggers our idea of equality, which is a concept that was there the whole time. It's kind of part of the package. I don't know if I'm not real up on computer lingo. I don't know if you would call it part of the hardware that comes with the computer or what. But this invisible world of unchanging eternal ideas or truths, Plato held to that. Now what Augustine did, he took these ideas and placed them into the mind of God. He said, yes, things like logic and, you know, the law of non-contradiction, equality concepts like time, space, all these things, these eternal, invisible, unchanging ideas or truths are the eternal ideas of God. And in essence, God knows everything in one eternal glance, one eternal thought, but that gets beyond our present purposes right now. Augustine argued that we cannot perceive the unchanging truths of things unless illuminated by God. Now, if I understand Augustine correctly, we would not be... See, when you point at a chair and you say, chair, you're doing more than saying that's an individual chair. You're saying that individual chair fits into the universal category called chair. So a lot goes on, even without making a sentence out of that chair. But Augustine argued, now here's a big area difference between Augustine and Aquinas. Aquinas, we drew all those things just through the natural reason alone, just through human reason alone. And we couldn't prove everything through human reason alone. That's Descartes. He went way overboard. But Aquinas, we could know certain things, the essences of things, through human reason alone. It's just in the data that God's given us. Augustine is saying, no, we actually need more help than we realize just in the everyday affairs that we go through. But in John 1:9, it reads, talking about Jesus, there was the true light which coming into the world enlightens every man. Now there's two ways of looking at this passage. And a lot of times the translators will translate it, they'll show you what their view is. There's two ways to look. One is that when Jesus came into the world, he enlightened every man. Now we know not everybody's saved, but maybe that he's drawn everybody to himself. But it doesn't seem to make much sense because it wouldn't be fair to everybody before him. Why wouldn't he be drawing them? But a lot of people like Gordon Clark have translated this verse, and Augustine seemed to as well, that the true light which enlightens every man, Jesus in his pre-incarnate state, he came into the world. So in other words, just for man to perceive a sense object and to just to have a sense experience, to look at this desk and say that is a desk, Augustine would say God has to turn the light on. And by the way, if that is true, we're going to see later on that it would answer Immanuel Kant's dilemma, where he would argue man can know reality as it appears to him. We can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. Augustine would argue, yeah, humanly speaking, we can never know the external world as it is. However, once you accept the God of the Bible, the Lord Jesus Christ enlightens every man. And so somehow, some way, we have direct contact and direct knowledge of that desk, that physical object, yet we can't explain how we know it. Through human reason alone, we always end up in Immanuel Kant's dilemma. Augustine would say that gap is bridged by the fact that the Lord Jesus Christ turns the light on inside. And by the way, the more I read presuppositionalists, the more I see that their human reason alone, starting from a blank slate, which is what Aquinas argued, it's pretty hard to make a case that you can know anything without an intelligent designer who designed the world in such a way and your mind in such a way that you can relate to and actually know objects external to your mind. Now, Augustine used his Platonic thought as an argument for God's existence, and I want to cover it here because we're not going to cover it later on when we go over arguments for God's existence. But just take a look at his thought, how his thought, we're going to see with Aquinas' thought was saturated with Aristotelian thought, Aristotle, whereas Augustine, it was Platonic thought, it was Plato's thought. Anybody ever see the pictures of two philosophers, Greek philosophers, walking around and one's pointing up and the other one's pointing down? Well, what it is Plato is the one who's pointing up. The invisible world of ideas. That's where he starts his argumentation, and that is ultimate reality. Whereas Aristotle, who does not deny universals, but sees the universals, the essences, as kind of existing in the objects themselves, he points down to the earth and says, no, we've got to start with the world of particulars and argue inductively to the universals rather than starting with the universals and arguing deductively down. So that's the big debate between the two. Well, Augustine started with Plato pointing up and Aquinas started with Aristotle pointing down, but they both ended up arguing, using those systems to argue for the truth of Christianity, and had much more agreement than disagreement, but they did have a different philosophical system. So although their theology was very close, their philosophical starting points were very different. Augustine argued that we have unchanging, eternal ideas in our minds. Such as, the law of non-contradiction. A cannot equal non-A. Okay? We have eternal ideas in our mind, unchanging ideas. But then Augustine argued, but our minds are not the adequate cause for these unchanging, eternal ideas. You see, our minds are changing. We change our minds a lot. Sometimes we add 3 + 2 and come up with 6. And our minds are limited by time. So Augustine argued that only an unchanging eternal mind, i.e. God, is the adequate cause of the unchanging eternal ideas. Now let me say this. This argument is very contested. There are a lot of non-Christian scholars and even Christian scholars will argue that it doesn't hold. But when you really get down to it, there does seem to be universal, eternal, unchanging truths that are above our minds and judge the ideas that we come up with. And it's kind of like the moral argument. There's moral values above all men. There has to be a moral lawgiver above all men. And if there's ideas above all men, the minds of all men, there's got to be a mind to place those ideas in. You know, Plato had a system with all these invisible ideas, and Augustine comes on the scene once he gets saved and says, you know what, Mr. Plato? Ideas don't make any sense unless they're generated by a mind. And an eternal mind, they would be the eternal, unchanging ideas. Now, during Augustine's time, there were a lot of skeptics, much like today. And so in order for Augustine to say that I'm a Christian and therefore I know something, he has to disprove or at least throw a monkey wrench into the thought of the skeptics, because the skeptics claim we can't know anything. So he refuted skepticism in two ways. He said, number one, it's rationally inconsistent. It's rationally or logically inconsistent. And number two, skepticism cannot be consistently lived. You can talk like a skeptic, but you can't practice what you preach. So number one, in Augustine's reputation of skepticism, it is rationally inconsistent. Skeptics claim to suspend judgment on all things. That's what a skeptic is. He's claiming that man cannot know. However, Augustine argued that skeptics do not suspend judgment on their skepticism. They choose to accept their skepticism and not pass judgment on that. So you can't be skeptical about everything. So they claim to know that man cannot know, which is a contradiction. So it's rationally inconsistent. That's number one. And number two, it cannot be consistently lived. Even skeptics do not suspend judgment when it comes to eating. If they're going to suspend judgment on everything, then they should suspend judgment. You know, if John was a skeptic, he would say that what is that, McDonald's or Burger King?
Burger King.
Burger King, okay, good man. It's healthy for you. They broil their burgers. But if John was a skeptic and a consistent one, he would starve to death because he would suspend judgment on determining whether or not that food is poison. But you can use an inductive argument and say millions of people have eaten at Burger King, and if you went to McDonald's, you know the exact number. Those boys would be correct. But he would say, well, you know, millions of people have eaten burgers there, and I haven't heard anybody being poisoned yet. Why should they poison me? And then we read about the obituary the next day. But a skeptic also will not suspend judgment when it comes to protecting oneself. If somebody's, Geisler gives the illustration, if a man's on the train tracks and hears the whistle of the train, even if he's a philosophical skeptic, he gets off the tracks. Okay? Augustine did some really good work right in his Confessions on time and eternity. The question came up, was there time before time began? Is time eternal? You see, if time was eternal, you would run into a form of Zeno's paradox, the Greek philosopher that predated Augustine by about 600-800 years. Zeno's paradox, when you apply it to time, if time is eternal and there never was a first moment, then you would have never reached the moment of creation, because in order to reach the moment of creation, you would have to traverse an actual infinite number of moments. But no matter how many moments you traversed, you would still have an infinite number more to traverse. So you never reach the moment of creation. You could never reach the moment now. No matter how many moments you would take to reach that, to reach now, you wouldn't have traversed an infinite number. So there had to be a first moment. So time had to have a beginning. And so what Augustine argued is that God exists in eternity. He exists in eternity, the eternal now. See, time has past, present, and future. Eternity has only one moment, the eternal now. Okay? And God exists outside time in eternity, and when he created changing things, that's when time began. In fact, time rightly understood, J.P. Moreland straightened me out on this, time rightly understood is not even our measurements of change. Time is actually change itself. Okay? But God exists outside of time and eternity. Now, by the way, there's a lot of guys that are denying that. Tom Morris out of Notre Dame, Ronald Nash, Douglas Grotius out of Denver Seminary. And I tell you, if you're going to throw out the Thomistic as Aquinas held to it too, and the Augustinian baby with the Augustinian bathwater, you're really, you know, the Christian, it took so long for somebody to stand up and refute Zeno's paradoxes in this area. And now what Christian thinkers are doing, because we're throwing Augustine and Aquinas out the window on this point, we're bringing back Zeno's paradox. And I don't understand, by the way, how God can exist outside time and act in it. But I also don't understand how God could be immaterial and create matter, how God could be immaterial and act in matter. But he can. So those are mysteries. But if you put God in time and say time is eternal, there's an infinite number of moments in time, then you've got a contradiction. And Zeno's paradox wins out. Also, getting almost a little bit off the subject, although this does come into conversation a lot, and the presuppositionalists, who are usually five-point Calvinists, will bring these things up. In divine sovereignty and human free will, Augustine took what we know of today as the Calvinistic position. The Calvin and Martin Luther, contrary to popular belief, both Calvin and Martin Luther got their ideas of divine sovereignty and human free will from Augustine. They did not, a lot of people think, you know, they went back to the Bible. No, they went to Augustine's interpretation of it. So I think the strongest case that can be made for five-point Calvinism is Augustine's writings and Augustine's influence on the church. The Bible, I think the only strong case would be Romans chapter 9, and then there's a passage in Isaiah. But I think when you see the other passages that strongly teach human free will, then you have to retain some strong sense of divine sovereignty, but still enough where a man can freely accept or reject Christ. But basically, Augustine argued that before the fall, man was able to not sin. But that after the fall, once man did sin, he was at that point not able to not sin. In other words, after the fall of mankind, all man could do was sin. He had no other choice. He could choose whether he's going to do a real bad sin or something really rotten like Hitler or something less rotten, but all he could do was sin. So, you know, you can give $1 million to the poor and you're still sinning if you're not saved. This view, if you hold to it, what that means then is that you cannot freely accept Christ. God has to regenerate you totally against your will, and when he regenerates you, you receive a new nature, and then from that nature you freely choose to accept Christ. After conversion, Augustine argued that once again man is able to not sin. Paul would say we're no longer slaves to sin, now we're slaves to righteousness. And then after glorification, when Jesus returns, we're not able to sin because we've been totally perfected. And, yeah?
Well, I have a question. On point B, that says not able to not sin. Why does that necessarily have to bring in not regeneration, that God has to regenerate you? Could that still be, could free will still be involved there?
Well, Not in the Augustinian sense. What I would say is that point B is the key thing. If you're going to retain that a person is free to accept Christ. Now, some scholars will write that Augustine contradicted his free will defense in the problem of evil, saying it was brought in by free will, because he wiped out free will in his view of divine sovereignty, human free will, but not so. Because Augustine is willing to grant that Adam and Eve were free before the fall. And he's willing to grant that Satan was free before his fall. But once they sinned, that was it. They were locked into it. If you understand sin there as a good portion of it as missing the mark, I will grant it. It just sounds weird to say accepting Christ is still sin. So the way that I word it See, because we cannot freely accept Christ in Augustine and Calvin and Luther's thought, God has to zap you, and then you can choose. So regeneration precedes faith. In my understanding, after the fall, we are not able to please God. We're not able to earn His favor. But that does not rule out the possibility of us accepting His grace, which is unearned. I think when an unsaved man gives $1 million to the poor, it's a good thing that he did. But it's not something that God will accept. God only accepts perfection. The only one that He's pleased with is His beloved Son, who when He came out of the water, He said, "This is My beloved Son, whom I am well pleased." And so Paul could say in Romans 8, verse 8, that it is impossible to please God in the flesh. Jesus Christ said, "Apart from Me, you can do nothing." But we do not earn God's favor by accepting Christ. But once we accept Christ, He indwells us with the Holy Spirit, who then regenerates us and works through us and empowers us to do works that God can accept. And then we'll reward Him the hereafter. But that's all I want to mention on Augustine. Now if we move to Anselm, Augustine, I'm trying to give an overview of his whole thought, his entire thought, which is obviously it's going to be tremendously lacking. And I'm going to try to do that with Aquinas, and I was really helped there with Aquinas because Geiser wrote such a dynamite book on him. And I might even try to do that a little bit with Blaise Pascal. But the rest of these guys, I'm just going to bring out aspects that I'm going to, Anselm did a lot more than just the ontological argument. But in a crash course in apologetics like we're going through right here, there wasn't anything that he said that is going to play a major role in this course that either Aquinas or Augustine didn't say either before him or better than him. Now, Aquinas came later, but if he said the same thing Anselm did, usually Aquinas said it more in depth. And Augustine said things before. In fact, you'll find even Anselm's ontological argument and René Descartes' Cogito Ergo Sum, I think therefore I am, both of those things came from Augustine. However, Augustine never used them as arguments to prove his cases. He just said it in passing. And they tried to pull out implications from what Augustine had said that he wouldn't have said. But Anselm lived from 1033 to 1109 A.D., and he's famous for the ontological argument. The ontological argument is an attempt to prove God's existence from reason alone. There is no attempt to argue from experience and from examining evidences in nature to God. The ontological argument, the argument is in the mind alone, okay? So keep that in mind. Two types of ontological argument that he gave. Now, he thought he was giving one type, but later scholars saw in it two different types, and some think one is fallacious, some think the other is fallacious, and others think they're both fallacious, and I don't know whether I'm coming or going on these arguments, so I just don't use them. First type, Anselm would say that God is defined as the greatest conceivable being. Even if you're an atheist, you should be willing to agree on that definition. God is the greatest conceivable being. The greatest being that you could think of, whether he exists or not. But then, Anselm will say, the implication of that, though, is that God must exist. For if he did not exist, we could conceive of a greater being. A being with the same attributes that God has, but then also exists. But then that being would be the greatest conceivable being, so that being would be God, therefore God must exist. Okay? Now, Immanuel Kant, he critiqued this. He said that existence is not a predicate. Basically, a predicate, if I say Phil is a man, anything, or Phil is good, Phil is nice, Phil is mean, all those things are predicates. After the little verb is, whatever you fill in the blank is an attribute or a predicate, okay? Well, Kant argued that just to say Phil is doesn't add any information about Phil. So to say Phil exists doesn't add any information. So in other words, Kant is saying it's a category mistake to act like you know, there's a whole bunch of perfections or predicates or attributes that God has to have as the greatest conceivable being, and one of those attributes is existence. Kant says, no, that's a whole different category. The greatest conceivable being must have all the perfections and must have them infinitely, but existence isn't even a perfection, so that doesn't tell us anything about whether or not this conceivable being, by conceivable we mean the greatest being in the mind, doesn't necessarily have to exist outside the mind. Okay? It was Kant, right? It depends. We get 50 philosophers in here, we'll start World War III arguing out. Most philosophers today, though, would say Kant was right on this. Then again, most philosophers today have been genuflecting before Kant for a long time. So, you know, they're going to agree with a lot of this stuff. Although they don't feel they don't really live as if thrust of what he was saying, you know, they act like we can know the world as it is. The second type of ontological argument is that, and some would say, that God is defined as a necessary being. Now, by the way, there's just three types of beings, and one of them can't even exist anyway, so it's really not even a type of being at all. But there's a possible being, which is a being that it isn't a contradiction. It's possible that it might exist and it might not exist. Okay? A possible being would be a unicorn. There's no logical contradiction there in a unicorn and a horse having a horn on its head. Okay? But that doesn't tell us whether or not it exists. It might be actual, it might not. Okay? So it's a possible being. We're possible beings because there was a time when we did not exist, so it's possible for us to not exist. Okay? That's a possible being. An impossible being is like a square circle. Okay? A square circle is a contradiction in terms. It's impossible for it to exist. Okay? But a necessary being, if there is, whether there is such a thing or not, we can say, well, what the exact opposite of an impossible being would be a necessary being. A being that must exist, a being that cannot not exist. And that's the way we define God, as a necessary. He's not a possible being, he has no possibility of non-existence. And he's not an impossible being because we believe he exists, so we define him as a necessary being. Well, the problem is a necessary being cannot not exist, therefore to say God, a necessary being, doesn't exist is a contradiction in terms. It's like saying John is a boy, but he's not a boy. That's a contradiction. Can't have it both ways. Therefore, God must exist. Now, Geisler's criticism of this, and Thomas Aquinas would use the same criticism, by the way. Of course, Geisler got it from Aquinas. Aquinas didn't get it from Geisler. And Geisler would be the first to admit it. He loves Aquinas. But Geisler's criticism is that it's logically possible that nothing exists. See, Alvin Plantinga, a philosopher from Notre Dame, wrote a whole book. Well, actually, half of the book is dealing with the problem of evil, but half of the book is on the ontological argument, and he uses Louis Molina, the Jesuit priest who died in this year 1600. He uses his possible worlds scenario. You know, an impossible world would be a world where square circles exist, or where free beings are not free beings, okay? But in every you have all these possible worlds, well, only one of them has been actualized. Well, basically, what Plotinga argues, he takes the ontological argument, he says that God, the greatest possible being, must exist in every possible world. But the actual world is a possible world, is one of those possible worlds. Because the only other alternative is that it be an impossible world. But if it was an impossible world, it would be impossible for it to be actual. But it's actual, so it has to be one of the possible worlds. So so Plotinga argues that the greatest possible being must exist as the greatest being in every possible world. since the actual world is one of the possible worlds, then the greatest possible being must exist in the actual world. Now, what Geisler argues, though, is that once you accept the existence of the actual world, you've left the realm of the mind. It's a valid argument, Geisler claims, but it's not an ontological argument from reason alone. Now you've done a cosmological argument, a weird type of cosmological argument, but you're arguing from the existence of the actual world to the existence of God. But it's because Geisler states it is logically possible that nothing exists. Now, I kind of agree with Geisler, except, just think about it for a minute, nothing exists. It's logically, there's no contradiction in saying nothing exists, is what Geisler's saying. The only open door I see for the ontological argument here is nothing is by definition non-being. And to have existence is to have being. So you could say, and maybe there's a fallacy in my thought here, but you can write nothing exists, you can write that down as non-being is being, which is a classical way to write out the law of non-contradiction, which means it's a contradiction, which means something must exist, which means, again, you wouldn't even have to leave the mind and you could prove God's existence through the ontological argument. Now, there might be a fallacy in my thought there, and it might fall back into the Kantian criticism. Kant, his philosophy, at the foundation, there's a distinction between the external world and the world of the mind. We can know reality as it appears, but we can't know reality as it is. So I wouldn't say let's give up the case to Kant right away. All I'm saying is the ontological argument, by the way, William Lane Craig, he lets you know that, hey, I respect this argument, and many philosophers today respect it. He won't use it. He's like me. He won't use it. But if Craig's not smart enough to refute it, and is going to suspend judgment on it, then I don't know why Phil Fernandez would just slam it down. But Geisler's done some great work. But again, he's coming from the Aquinas type of view, and Aquinas and Kant are worlds apart here. There is almost nothing in common there at their starting points. But anyway, that's Anselm, two types of ontological argument. Thomas Aquinas lived from 1225 A.D. to 1274 A.D. Man, his work is really misunderstood. I'm really glad that Geisler wrote that work on Thomas Aquinas. If you get a chance to pick it up, it is just a fantastic work. And Thomas Aquinas, an Evangelical Appraisal, and then he's got it subtitled, Should All Aquinas Be Forgot? So, pretty swift there. Norm's got a good sense of humor, except when I ask him questions. Okay, anyway, his most famous work, Aquinas, is the Summa Theologica. I've got the abridged version. It's actually about five volumes long, real thick volumes. By the way, Augustine's City of God is like about the size of the World Book Encyclopedia, so you can get an 800-page abridged version through Penguin Books, which is pretty good, put together by a Catholic scholar that really knew his thought well. Aquinas was influenced by Aristotle. Keep that in mind. Aquinas, Aristotle, but Augustine, it was Plato. So that means Aquinas is going to start with the world of the senses. Aquinas argued that our minds start out life as a blank slate. Now, I used to hold that view, but Gordon Clark convinced me when I read his works that there's no way you can look at a mound of dirt and get moral values from it. You come into this life with some conscious, some idea of right and wrong, even if it's in the subconscious realm and it gets triggered by something in the physical realm, whatever. I just disagree that we start. I think that we're a blank slate. My epistemology, my theory of knowledge, combines Augustine, i.e. Plato, and Aristotle, Aquinas. And I see Aquinas' observations to hold true for the conscious mind. We start out life with the blank slate in the conscious mind, but in the subconscious realm, there's got to be some either innate ideas or innate ability. But you could argue that Aquinas argued that we just had innate ability to draw rational conclusions from sense experience. It's really tough. What was his name? Charles Hodge spends about 100 pages on this dynamite work on his view of innate ideas and stuff like that, and or basically innate ability to draw ideas. And he's somewhere in between Augustine and Aquinas, and he was a great thinker himself.